Hey there, Solar Warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in, and welcome to our tribe. Hey, hey, Solar Warriors, welcome to a special holiday version of Suncast. Happy Thanksgiving to those of you faithful few who do actually listen on the day that episodes are produced. I am so honored that you're taking time on your turkey day. Maybe the tryptophan is kicking in, you're kicking back and relaxing with the latest episode. I know there are several of you who fall in that category, and thank you for taking the time to do that. If you're new here to Suncast, well, also really, really grateful to have you on board as well. I hope that you'll find the next hour of your life well invested and that you are tuning up your skills, that you're learning everything that you need to know about the solar and clean tech business. That's what we do here on Suncast. We curate the stories, life and times, obstacles and career growth strategies of the industry's leading professionals, executives, founders, and pioneering fathers. In many ways, today's guest falls in that pioneering fathers category. My dear friend Arnold Leitner, an entrepreneur and pioneer in his own right, founded a company called SkyFuel that, as I was kicking off my career way back in 2005, was already taking on investor dollars and cranking out a really novel product in the concentrating solar photovoltaic industry. For those of you who've been following along, CSP has been sidetracked lately by the ridiculously fast-dropping costs of photovoltaics, regular silicon PV. And Arnold and I get into how, as a young entrepreneur in his late 20s, early 30s, he had to pivot his career away from the technology he had selected and raised money for towards what the inevitability of the industry was going to be. I have so much respect for this entrepreneur and the way that he has learned to thrive and pivot, raise money, and satisfy customers and investors alike in his 20 years in clean tech. I hope that you will enjoy this interview as much as I did. And if you, like many on your Thanksgiving holiday, have extra time and you're looking to queue up more episodes like this, well, then I would encourage you to check out the more than 300 additional founder stories and startup advice from the clean tech front lines over at mysuncast.com. So many solar and energy founders in our history and catalog, our history. I don't know why I said it that way. You can also subscribe to the podcast right there in your podcast player or Spotify, wherever it is that you are. So you'll know the next time we let another episode out into the wild. For now, I hope that you will tune up your ears and tune up your skills, Solar Warrior, because we're going to tune in to this Thursday Thanksgiving edition of Suncast with my friend Arnold Leitner. All right, Solar Warriors, as promised, today's conversation is going to be wide-ranging with an entrepreneur I've been watching and have come to respect over the last decade, who is uniquely a clean tech pioneer, and specifically for the Suncast platform, the first time that I've had the opportunity to chat with someone who has crossed the chasm between two different types of solar technology, specifically having had success, but come to a realization of where the market was going and been able to pivot. As I mentioned in the intro, Arnold Leitner is a pioneer in the solar industry, getting his start in concentrating solar power with a company that I respected highly at the time that they were active in the marketplace, a company called SkyFuel. We'll talk a bit about how SkyFuel came about, and we'll talk about, obviously, the company that he currently is at the helm of, a company called U-Solar. But first, welcome, Arnold, to Suncast.
Well, thank you, Nico, for having me on.
Indeed, it has been a long time coming. Can you give me a sense of the first real exposure that you had to the world of clean energy and how you knew that this is where you wanted to take or focus your career?
Yeah. You know, these founding or founder stories sometimes sound incredibly untrue and made up. And so will this, but it is in fact what happened to me. I was about 12 years old. We had a small in-school library next to the arts room. Everything was old-fashioned in Germany. And I checked out a book on energy. And you remember those books in the 80s that had only a few color pages in the middle? The rest was black and white printed, and often the print wasn't very high quality. So I checked that book out, and it was talk about energy. I was getting fascinated. It had these diagrams that show you, you know, gross energy coming in, flowing out to waste heat and so forth. And I came across this one picture. To this day, I can see it in front of my eyes. It showed a train, just freight trains on rails. And it said that inside of this train were low-level radioactive waste from a nuclear power plant, and that would have been secured or secluded for 10,000 years. And it just struck me that moment that that was not going to be a practical way of running our energy world. And it was really genesis of me getting interested in trying to understand what can we do. Because at that time, I already had understood that burning fossil fuels was not an option. And the reason I was so early into this, is because we had acid rain. We had lots of problems in Germany at the time. And so I was aware already of coal-fired power and all these issues, not strictly linked to climate change. So I was looking around, and then with that realization, I came to think there must be something else.
At the ripe old age of 12, and you mentioned briefly, but you grew up in Germany, correct?
That's correct, yes.
How'd you find your way over to America?
Yeah, I like to think there's a more interesting story, but related to my academic interests. But the truth was, I was fascinated by the Canadian North, and I paddled up in the Yukon Northwest Territories with my best friend Chris, also German. We were 19 and 21 at the time when we pushed off our boats deep in the Canadian wilderness. And at some point, I developed this idea that if I wanted to do this more often, I should live closer. So I was just trying to find a way to live in North America so I can go to the Canadian North more easily. And then, you know, one thing led to the other, and eventually I made it to Boulder, Colorado.
Boulder, where National Renewable Energy Lab.
But that was not the coincidence. That is now not a coincidence. So I was, you know, you have to make the right move. And so I was trying to look for a university that was in solar research. And there's a story previous to that, but we can skip over that. So I found it with the University of Colorado Boulder and also the Colorado Schools of Mines, both of which were close to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, each of which had a professor that would take me on as a graduate student in photovoltaic research.
Well, you have a PhD in physics. It's one of the things that becomes quite helpful when you are trying to help perpetuate or launch an industry, as you did. Help me understand the work that you went on to do at NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, and how that became SkyFuel.
Yeah. So my contact with NREL came after my academic career. So as it turned out, by the time I had shown up in Boulder, I was ready to start my PhD research, which is the second year into your graduate work in the physics department. It turned out that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory didn't receive the funding or specifically the advisor that was working with me that allowed me to pursue this research I'd come over for. So I did a doctorate in superconductivity. But when I came out, and this is exactly where you and I first make contact, I was invited by the consulting firm I worked for, which is now Standard & Poor's Global Platts, to write a study about the potential of solar for the Western United States as a real energy source. And during that time, I became a consultant to NREL, the Department of Energy, and I invited, and this is something that will bring a smile to your face, and invited the entire solar industry to a meeting in Washington, D.C., and all the 12 of us came into the room, right? I mean, I not everyone was there, obviously, but it was a small industry. Even First Solar was there. Ammonix, companies that now history, were present. And then that led to me understanding the issues surrounding solar, the potential of technology, and that led to SkyFuel.
I remember that SkyFuel was unique in a number of dimensions. I shared with you that it was one of the companies that I bookmarked and said, these guys are challenging the way that we think about lots of different things. Not only that, but their website is innovative and unique in the way that it presents information and the way that it flows. I think I recall that it was one of the first kind of parallax websites that caught my attention. But one of the truly creative ways that you helped to, I would say, spur CSP, concentrating solar power, was rethinking how to capture, how to harness the sunlight. How was concentrating solar power in the aughts being developed, and how did SkyFuel challenge that notion?
Yeah, so the first was, you know, most importantly, the way the traditional standard platform was being built, and that's the parabolic trough collector. For those who are not familiar with concentrating solar power today, back then, you should have imagined a trough-like structure, like a half-cut parabola, and there was a pipe at the focal line of that parabola, and it would pivot with the sun and heat, typically in oil, and that light was reflected onto that pipe with heavy glass mirrors. These were literally bent glass mirrors, and anyone who has ever brought home a glass panel of any sort knows how heavy that is, and that was the standard industry. This was sagged glass. This was a mirror that was, you know, let to sag in a thermal annealing process. And then there was a metal structure out of steel that held these mirrors in place. And it was very heavy, very expensive, and complicated to transport. I mean, again, you would be moving thousands or tens of thousands of these mirror panes. So our approach was to say, well, you know, the force of a photon impinging on a mirror is infinitesimally small, right? It requires no effort, no force to throw it back. So why not put something extremely light at it, as light as possible? And the idea was to use a mirror film. You don't need much, you know, to reflect a photon. Why do you have all these heavy glass mirrors? So ultimately, what we came to design was also aluminum space frame, which is much more customizable. That's why there's extruded aluminum, right, versus extruded steel. The latter doesn't exist because it's complicated. But with extruded aluminum, we can create the kind of shapes and forms you need to make a really beautiful space frame, and then have that hold a mirror pane that's basically a film on a floppy aluminum panel that gets its shape just like a sail gets its shape when the wind blows into it. And it gets its shape by being inserted into rails. And the beautiful thing was that all mirrors would be shipped flat. They were lightweight. It was a beautiful, very strong space frame. And then you inserted everything on site. And it derived its own optics through the insertion process. It was pretty beautiful. It was really beautiful.
Was the innovation around SkyFuel the lightweight nature of the product? Or was there an additional advantage in terms of deployment?
So there was another aspect, which was the linear Fresnel system. And I'll speak to that in a moment. But with regards to parabolic trough was the realization that we got to do this differently, right? We got to stop using glass mirrors and space frames, steel space frames, if you want to move the technology up in size. You can't scale with glass. It will essentially deform under its own weight. And everyone who remembers the Space Hubble, Hubble telescope problem with the sagging glass out on its own weight, that's a similar problem here. So if you want to get to 10, 12 meter parabolic dishes, this is very large structures, you had to go a different way. You just couldn't scale up. And the reason you wanted to scale up is, of course, to get the cost down, but also to possibly introduce molten salts into the receiver tube. And there's a certain economy of size that, you know, there's issues of freeze protection, all of which become scalable and doable once you go up in size. Now, that was really the observation. And I believe to this date that if we hadn't had the trifecta of the financial crisis of 2008, the low-cost photovoltaic coming from China, and the crash of the natural gas market, that molten salt solar thermal technologies would still have a stronger place in the market because their energy storage is very affordable and very effective. So that was the goal of the lightweight parabolic trough, to reach that point. And, you know, we made it there, but then, of course, all of these things came together, which we'll probably talk later about, which didn't allow SkyFuel to go all the way to where we had it intended to go.
Well, I don't think we need to hold back to later in the story. Actually, I'm curious to know, just for context, my recollection is that around the time of SkyFuel, you were in your early 30s. So coming out of a PhD program, you came up with this idea, you licensed the technology from NREL. How did you assemble the team and the technology? I believe you licensed the technology from NREL to make this happen, right? And then you went and raised money. How'd that go about?
SkyFuel came to its technology was very interesting. For one, I had decided that I had a firm understanding of the power markets and the opportunities for concentrating solar power in the desert Southwest, which primarily revolved around the ability of solar thermal to inject steam into existing combined cycle power plants. of which there was a massive overbuild, and they were literally sitting by themselves in the middle of the desert and surrounded by open space. And they had been oversized in their steam turbine capacity based on assumptions that that steam turbine capacity could be used in the power markets as a form of peaking plant by injecting additional heat, burning additional natural gas in the heat recovery steam generator. So that was my realization that that would be a big opportunity. And so I was looking for technology and basically put a flag down in the sand saying, come to me, I have a business plan. And so with that claim that I have an idea how to bring this into the market, I went out and met people. And, you know, back then in the early 2000s, you know, the heydays of the solar thermal industry had long been gone. There was a resurgence of that in Europe, but it was still languishing, you know, in the United States as an opportunity that no one was taking charge of. And so you would find people that got excited by a young, you know, 35-year-old Columbia MBA saying, hey, you know, I think I got the money and I think I know how to get us into the market. And so I found a very capable solar thermal technology expert who I brought on as CTO, and he had been working with the National Renewable Energy Laboratories on that mirror film technology, which we later marketed as ReflectTech.
Yeah. How did you find this technical co-founder?
Randy G. Yeah. So Randy, I knew him indirectly, I think. I knew him more indirectly through a contact in the CSP industry, and basically invited myself to his house and said, look, this is what I have. What do you think? And look, if you had been part of the first solar boom and then, you know, nothing really happened and someone walks in and looks like they, you know, have the understanding of the market and the money to do something, you know, lots of people would get excited to be part of that. And that's what we did. He had been in the solar for a long time. He had a company in Golden, in I think it was called Industrial Solar Technology. And they had built a small low temperature parabolic trough solar concentrator that was used for hot water. And they had done a number of installations with commercial customers and also, I think, with the corrections facilities in the desert southwest. But he had this idea that this could be scaled up. This film that I came up with could be bigger. And so I presented the opportunity for Randy to say, okay, let's go, let's make this bigger. And then, of course, you know, you find an easy target with me, someone who loves technology, understands technology, I hope, and says, I got it, I'm with you, let's do this.
There is always a point where, as a founder, you realize this is going to work or this isn't going to not work. As I recall, somewhere around 2009, you had an interesting conversation with the then CEO of Sempra Generation that gave you a sense this maybe isn't going in the right direction. Can we talk about what essentially was for you sort of the end of Sky Fuel and how that gave you the impetus and the ideas for what was to come?
Our whole premise was, you know, we can't beat conventional power in the market. But if you only provide solar steam to an existing combined cycle power plant, then the entire power generation facility becomes a sunk cost. It has already been built and it's not being utilized because the market did not arrive for these power plants. And many of them were restructured financially. So, and it turned out coincidentally that the temperature of the steam that was inside of the heat recovery steam generator. So folks need to think of this kind of like a bunch of tubes that get hit by hot air that comes out of the jet engine that is the gas turbine. The gas turbine itself, just like in a plane, powers a generator, but then whatever comes out in the back gets reused one more time to heat up water. And sometimes, you know, or most of the times, they added extra burners into that exhaust, just like an afterburner on a jet. And then the steam turbine that is driven by that steam cycle was oversized because of the afterburner called duct firing. And that capacity was significant. We talked about 50 megawatts, I apologize, for a typical combined cycle power plant. That's a large solar farm back then. And so the idea, let's integrate this. And we were working with Sempra and Mike Allman on their power plant near Boulder City, Nevada. I didn't know that at the same time, we were also in competition with First Solar, who also was talking with Sempra. And we had come in with something like 10 cents per kilowatt hour for the cost of energy, which is unheard of, but which was possible because we're using basically the rest of the plant for free because it had no other use. We're close to making a deal, moving forward, and we were able to build some 50 megawatts at that facility. And then Mike Allman told me, well, you know, we're going with the first solar. We're building this first PV power plant. It was, I believe, 10 megawatts at a time or 20, which was revolutionary in size. And I came to the conclusion of the following. I knew that our standalone pricing for full-in combined cycle power plant with the generating facility, everything combined, was coming in at least at 25 cents per kilowatt hour. So if Mike Allman, who I knew was not a dummy, would sign a contract with a PV company, it must have been anywhere between our 10 and our 10 cents per kilowatt hour and the 20 kilowatt hour target. And that told me that the game was over, because after we repowered these combined cycle power plants, well, then we would have to build our own standalone power plants, right? There are only that many opportunities in the field. Well, after that, we would be competing at some 20 plus cents against someone who's building today at 15. And it was at that point that I went over to my team first, my investors next, and the board at the same time, and told them, look, it's game is over, right? Because there's only that many combined cycle power plants we can use to incubate, bring the technology into market, and then we have to build standalone power. And now we have a competitor out there that's coming in at prices that are below our target.
I've been wondering, what's your least favorite solar asset management activity? You know, those daily, weekly, sometimes monthly deliverables that you just have to check off the list but can be such a drag. Well, let me tell you how to press the easy button and get going on the work that really matters by automating your invoicing and ticketing and reporting with PowerHub. Focus on the work that you want to do. Take the boring stuff off your plate with PowerHub. You can go to powerhub.com/suncast to learn more. So for those who listened to way back in the day, Suncast episode with the eponymous Dan Sugar, the rest of the story will sound mildly familiar. You realized, as many who were working on concentrating solar power, that part of the underlying technology of SkyFuel was in the tracker. Help me understand a bit of sort of your last days at SkyFuel and some of the proposals that you made that at the time, we're talking 2008, 2009, were definitely ahead of their time.
Yes. So poorly for me in timing, Solar Millennium was signing up hundreds of million dollars contracts with the utilities in Southern California. At the same time, I was going to my investors, the board, and told them that the game is over.
Saying this isn't going to work, yeah.
This is not going to work. And so then, of course, immediately was to point into the press release and say, look at those guys, they're selling power plants, people are buying this, you're not right, you know, you're wrong, your analysis is not correct. And I said, well, you know, they will be losing their shirt, this will not have a happy ending because numbers just don't lie. And I told them also plainly, these power plants will never get built. And indeed, I think for 75-80% of them, they never got built. Some got pulled through out of bad conscience by the CPUC in California. You know, the one another was built against the better knowledge that prices had dropped dramatically. But going back, I looked at the company and realized, look, we're expert in solar resource assessment. We have a team of 35 people. We have a 40,000 square foot facility. I believe it was the former Rocky Flats decommissioning site, a warehouse. And we know everything about tracking. And the one thing that the solar panels also needed, the regular PV, was tracking. So while it tracked at much lower accuracy, we were tracking it in a fraction of a degree. And those guys only have to track at 1 or 2 degrees. Well, how hard it is to become sloppy, right? And so my thought was, well, let's take the solar thermal technology aspect, the parabolic trough, the wonderful mirrors, and pains us as much as we thought we just built something incredible, and sell it off to someone who still sees a market in that. And so, you know, we thought there was plenty of buyers still in the Middle East for that technology or otherwise elsewhere. And then take the team, take all of our experience in tracking and space frame design, and come up with the best tracker that we could come up with. And you mentioned Dan Sugar.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what Dan did.
And that's, you know, right. And at the same time.
Yeah, but next tracker.
He joined Solaria January 2010. And about a year later, he spun out what we now know as Next Tracker.
Yes.
With the exact same hypothesis.
Yes. And, you know, I couldn't be happier for him. And as a matter of fact, it's been my star that I point to and say, look at him, right?
I was right.
Look what we could have done, right?
Exactly.
We would have had to split the bounty in half presumably because both of us might have been successful, but he'd had a phenomenal exit, and he's still with Nextracker. And that's exactly what we had to do. You know, you have to, there was this famous sailing ship that was built to haul oil down the eastern seaboard at the early 19th century. And it was the largest sailing ship ever built in a futile attempt to compete one more time with the steam engine. And that ship actually sank in the Caribbean and created the world's first oil spill. And I brought that picture up. I saw New York Times an example of obsolete technology. And I brought it up in this meeting with my team that I mentioned earlier. I just saw this black and white photo and asked the unsuspected team after my call with Mike Allman and a week of thinking over this, said, "What is this on the wall?" And I said, "Well, that's a sailing ship." "No," I said, "that's obsolete technology." Okay. And we just built that. Right. But there's great technology in there. So let's take, you know, what is good about it and apply it to the new world. That was what I was trying to take SkyFuel. I was trying to take SkyFuel forward.
As we fast forward a bit, we'll skim over the salty reality that as a young CEO who saw the real future, but didn't align with your peers in the marketplace, you were ousted by the board. Yet in that time, 2004 to 2010, you came to the realization that storing energy was the actual key to scaling the industry.
We'll take it a step further, and I'll have a counter thesis for you in a moment. I think there was a double realization that occurred, and it came to me. I was doing, you know, initially, as with every founder, you hang on to what you know best and try to think of the next solar thermal power venture. And eventually, you know, even your own train hasn't stopped rolling down the tracks, although you'd pulled the brake a long time ago. So eventually that train stopped, and I said to myself, okay, what's next? And, you know, I had a young son on the way, and so I ended up doing photovoltaic large-scale solar project development in Canada, and gave me some time to, in Ontario, which was a good market at the time, gave me some time to think things through. And then I put my, and this gets to your question, I put my phone into a solar charger. And an iPhone obviously is a battery, right? There's a battery inside, and there's a solar panel. And I plugged it in and realized, oh my goodness, once you combine a solar panel with an iPhone, you're completely energy independent. Well, how about you make this bigger? And I came to realize that, no, that was way before the Tesla Powerwall, right? But I realized that these technologies are very, very complicated. But a key observation was, if I wanted to take solar off the track, and the track being utility grid, and the reliance on the entire solar industry to work with and depend on utility, if we wanted to take it off the tracks and do something that could go anywhere in the world, we need to combine it with storage. Because we need to have something that works anywhere, whether the grid is up or the grid is down. So storage became a critical part of this whole design, but also, and we can talk about this more, the very nature of the architecture, how to build such a system, how to make it really the Apple of the solar industry or the innovative technology of the future. We can talk about this in a moment, but our challenge, the talking point of the industry, the last mile of distributed solar or distributed renewable energy in general, but solar specifically, because it's de facto the one that we will fall all into, because it's abundant and everywhere. The last mile is an energy storage. It's solved. The problem is completely solved. We can buy 1 kilowatt hour of high-performance lithium-ion batteries from China with the battery management systems for $160 per kilowatt hour. That is plenty cheap for any place where you overcome cost of distribution generation. The last mile is power. It is not energy storage. Once you deliver your own power, the entire power to run all the appliances at the house, you become free of the utilities. Only then can you turn the power grid into an energy source. And here's the example that people don't think rationalize. The distribution system in your neighborhood is 10 times bigger than it needs to be to deliver average energy. And let's take the data for a house. A house, say, has a 10 kilowatt peak demand, on average, it will only consume 1 kilowatt. Now, if you then produce half of that with solar energy on your roof, that would mean if you were able to store that energy locally and produce all of the 10 kilowatts locally, your energy pipe to your house only would have to be 500 watts. And that infrastructure cost is dramatic. Those are the poles outside the house you don't like. Those are the lines dangling in front of your view. And that is the infrastructure yet has to be built to deliver power to billions of people in emerging markets. So if you can get rid of that cost and that infrastructure is when you really transform the industry. And that's what the power block does. It's a high power system that delivers whole home power. And that's really the game changer. So number one thesis is that energy storage was critical to build a system that no longer relies on the utility system for storage, which is the net metering. The second thing is, if you introduce a battery, its most important attribute, I didn't get to that, especially of lithium-ion batteries, period, and lithium-ion phosphate in particular, is its ability to deliver high sustained power until the battery is dead. You can run a lithium-ion phosphate battery from 100% down to zero at its full discharge rate. So now that's not possible for lead-acid battery, as you know. You know, after cranking a while, the battery needs to recover. And as it turns out, the discharge power of batteries, of lithium-ion batteries, is high enough that paired with the adequate amount of energy storage that you need, you can actually meet the total peak demand of a house in terms of power. So a typical residential home with about 10,000 kilowatt hours of annual consumption needs about 25 kilowatt hours of energy storage to cycle all of the solar through its own system, not net meter, and be energy independent from power outages, you know, for a couple of days. That 25 kilowatt hours delivers 25 kilowatts of power. That is enough. If you took a 25 kilowatt hour car battery, I don't have the exact number in front of me, it probably would deliver 2.5 kilowatts of power, but it's absolutely inadequate for a home. And that is the game changer. A lithium-ion battery doesn't only create cheaper energy storage, it suddenly provides a high power source that can run until the battery is empty. So energy storage is viewed as the holy grail of distributed energy storage. And energy storage is the holy grail of distributed power. And I'm sure you have heard that many times, right?
Yeah, of course.
And my answer is that problem has been solved. Okay. And that is not the real important distinction of a lithium-ion phosphate, lithium-ion batteries. The real game changer, it's yin and yang. Yes, without energy storage, we couldn't do one. But the one thing that comes for free that absolutely, you know, with the storage that really changes everything now is the ability of those batteries to deliver high power over a sustained period of time. And that allows you to reduce the connection to the grid, the power rating of your pipe by a factor of 10, if not 20. And now the underlying infrastructure can be much simpler.
How does the average homeowner experience the cost of the underlying infrastructure versus the future that you want to portray?
Well, at least a third of your cost of utility bill is that underlying infrastructure. The generation cost, the energy cost, is usually a much smaller fraction of your bill. Historically, and I would have to get myself a little bit up to date on this, Nico. One-third is billing, one-third transmission distribution, one-third energy. So if you're self-sustained, well, you're cutting out the billing, right? Don't you? And if you don't use a distribution system, you're cutting out that cost as well. So you can now compete against a cost that is three times higher than what your own cost is, and you're still in the money. Because you don't have to pay, if you have a standalone power block that's energy independent, off-grid, you don't pay for this billing, and you don't pay for distribution costs. You only care comparing, you know.
Yeah, so in the theoretical, that's true. How does this free up utility resources to focus on other areas to solve? Because obviously they're not going to really enjoy the notion that is inevitable that we're going to take away the need for them to be responsible for or owning those pieces of the puzzle. So where does this leave utilities?
So, okay, yes, it leaves stranded assets. So the first observation that we'll have is that people will come in and say, well, I have a PG&E connection for 200 amp to my house. That's a 48 kilowatt connection. And they say, well, but dear Public Utility Commission, I'm only drawing 10 amperes at a maximum. Why am I paying for this? It's sunk cost. It's, you know, I don't want to pay the $20 a month hookup fee. I don't want to be charged for all this cost. I'm not using it. And eventually you get a groundswell of people saying, look, you know, we deliver our own power to the house. We're drawing 250 watts from PG&E. Why are they allowed to put this on my rate base? And then there's the next issue, of course, is that of the last line customers. This is a far-reaching conversation, Nico. And the issue is here, there's technology now there that makes the old business model obsolete. And if you never heard this before, you hear it from me first, that's the time when things change. Okay. So take this customer up in Napa Valley that lives 3/4 of a mile with a single house at the end of the power line. Getting those lines cut free of branches to avoid a fire being caused by swinging lines costs PG&E $25,000 every 2 years, right? For one customer, just because typically you would put this over the entire rate base. And now someone says, why am I paying for that person? He should get a power block installed. And he is entirely independent, and that power line now can be a fraction of the size. And by the way, because he's energy storage and he has all the power to his home, his well pump will still run, his air conditioner will still run with the power block, we're going to turn him off on a regular basis. So if we have a red flag alert, he just gets turned off immediately.
There's no current, meaning there's no electricity arriving.
There's no electricity flowing in the line. And the reality is, the reality is if you provide your own power to your home, and you store energy in your batteries. In the summer months, and this will something we have to talk later about emerging markets. In the summer months, your grid connection will be down for months. Take that house in Big Sur that's off-grid that we did. It has a generator, okay? Because the generator represents the grid connection, right? It's the grid. Well, that generator doesn't run for weeks and months in the summer. That's like that house in that moment is truly off-grid if you think of it as a solar-powered home. And so similar, that homeowner in Napa at the end of that power line that costs a fortune to maintain and who loses power when there's a red flag alert, that person's power can be turned off without power that person ever noticing because they're already energy independent to start with. And that suddenly saves us ratepayers $25,000 every 3 years to go down and cut that power line free.
And that money can be reinvested in other assets.
That money can be reinvested in renewables, in social, why are we paying $25,000 when we can't support low-income families with the energy bill?
So for those who haven't perhaps familiarized themselves with U-Solar, the company that you've started, PowerBlock is a product that you make. So the reference here is PowerBlock is a specific product to U-Solar. But how much would that customer to deploy a power block or a similar type of technology would that cost, even if the utility took it on as a rate base?
A power block for a typical home, and that's all associated with the amount of energy storage, to become a typical single family home is somewhere currently, and this includes the solar array, the high power inverters. You can't compare this with a Tesla Powerwall, say it has a 5 kilowatt inverter when we bring in a 16 kilowatt inverter that's capable of 32 right. kilowatts. You have to compare apples to apples. We basically give you a utility replacement, and the cost for a single family home, depending on size and energy consumption, can be somewhere between $35,000 and $50,000.
Yeah, and that's for an equivalent roughly 10 kilowatt system, is that right?
No, that would be a solar system, about 5 to 6 kilowatt solar.
Okay, so similar size, but with 25 kilowatt hours of storage.
Of 25 to 30, the storage, and we'll go about the storage is steep. I'll talk about this in a moment. But then you have the high power inverter that's currently 16 kilowatt inverter with a 20 kilowatt inverter with a 32 kilowatt peak amount. The high power batteries to help power electronics that make their work, the ability to seamlessly integrate a generator, all of that is wrapped into PowerBlock, including its intelligence. For example, for the homeowners in fire country, we deliver real time hourly production forecasts from our satellite-based system, which detects the smoke plume, makes the generator start on early to fill up the batteries in off-grid environments, or draws from the grid early to charge the batteries. All the things are fully integrated. So the whole package is about between $35,000 and $50,000, depending on the size of the home.
Well, it seems like that's something that, assuming as an industry, we are able to help regulators and utilities realize the value of these products, we can also help to structure policies and regulations that would allow the utilities to reinvest some of the saved money into incentive programs that can cover the cost of these end of the line systems that eventually 10, 20, well, immediately, but 10, 20, 30 years down the road, we are avoiding millions of dollars of infrastructure costs to renew a failing grid. What's fundamentally difficult in the architecture of storage? I want someone who maybe doesn't have a higher education degree in physics to be able to understand the essential problem that we're trying to solve.
Specifically with regards to the battery, there's the issue of the electric potential of the battery. And that sounds, which people usually refer to as the volts, how many volts the battery has. And you want to get that potential up high. You want to get it near around 400 volt, which makes everything smaller in terms of its size, because you push less current through the equipment, being that inverters, converters, anything you're using. And just give you a scale, a 50 volt battery, which is the standard in the telecom industry, and a 400 volt battery has a difference in cable sizing for the same amount of power to flow of a factor of 60. That's 60x. So if you ever looked at a car battery with these thick leads on there, that's obviously because a 12-volt battery has very low potential and drives high current. So when you come to batteries, how do you get to that high potential? How do you get to 400 volt? Well, you have to stack small cells on top of each other. It's like literally like taking your AA battery and welding the plus to the minus and keep going until you're adding those small cell potentials up to 400 volt.
Right. And this is what Tesla does in their power packs
right.
for the cars.
That's right. Yep. But there's a challenge in this, is if one of them in that little chain fails, then the entire chain fails, right?
It's like, it's like the old Christmas lights.
The old Christmas light analogy. So what you do, you put many of those changed in parallel. And so if you want to get a certain ratio of reliability to high electric potential, you put a certain number in parallel. And then if one chain fails, oh, well, I have all the other chains. But if you could stay at 50 volt, then the number of parallel chains can go down because the chance of making a mistake goes down. And so you can ultimately have less long chains and fewer chains in parallel, you get a lighter product. But then you have a terrible 50-volt battery, which has 60 times thicker cables. So how do you solve that problem? You solve that problem through power electronics, and you solve it through a bidirectional converter, which is a system that steps up the electric potential, the voltage, from the 50 to around 400. And that's some of our core technology that we bring to the market, and now allows us to break down the battery into sizes that an individual can carry. It also turns the battery into modules, where if one module fails, because batteries will fail, I just returned my Hilti charging battery for my power drill after 5 cycles, right? It failed after 5 cycles. So batteries do fail, but now if I have 5 5-kilowatt-hour batteries and one of them fails, well, the other 20 kilowatt hours will continue to work until I can have that replaced.
It sounds like what's happening in the storage industry is very similar to what happened in the power electronics industry over the last 30 years. I mean, the kinds of analogies that you're drawing are what many who are familiar with solar PV system architecture would begin to connect the dots on how inverters have been optimized and how, in fact, products like Enphase and Tigo and Solar Edge have revolutionized the way our power electronics industry allows us to reduce the overall complexity and headache of connecting PV panels to the electrical system. Is that correct, or am I making
that? That's absolutely correct. Okay. You know, I want to celebrate in a moment the Tesla car, because we all know it. It's a phenomenal piece of technology. But let's strip away a little bit what it's unique about Tesla. Let's say, is it the tires that make the Tesla car special? I doubt it, right? You can get tires anywhere. The windshield? No. The leather seats? No. The blinkers? No. So if you strip it down, you come back to the battery. Like the battery? No. Until recently, before the Gigafactory, they purchased those from Sony, I believe. So at the end, if you strip it all down, what is Tesla Motors? It's the software and the power electronics, right? And what converts that energy into drivetrain power. And so if you go back to what you just started with, for the industry, it is also the power electronics that makes the batteries and the solar panels interact and work with the grid or on its own. And that's where the magic lies.
Yeah.
That's the innovation.
And I feel even this is extremely useful, I believe, for even homeowners who are listening, who might be very unclear on how to evaluate a technology partner. And that is what you're getting when you buy a 25-year warranty product for your home. It's a technology partner, just the same way when you buy a Hilti drill, you hope to not have to replace it in a year or two. So the ability to evaluate their software and power electronics stack, something you wouldn't effectively be able to empower many homeowners to do. So do you have any thoughts around how to help homeowners or even lay people in the solar industry differentiate between who's doing well, who's not? How do you know the difference between a U-Solar or a Sonnen?
Yes. So in the end, you know, we truly rely on the installers to be the vetters of the technology, because they will come in and say to homeowners, I can get you a bright box from LG Chem. And by the way, all of these companies make great products, right? I can sell you a power wall. I can send you an LG Chem. a Sonnen or a Power Block. And here's why you should choose of them. And yeah, because we will do what we can to advertise the brand and project what we can do with the Power Block. But ultimately, it's going to be installers helping the customer say, look, you know, we have done this and that. We've seen how things actually work. And here's why you should choose a Power Block. Hopefully, it's so simple. It's so reliable. You know, you can integrate a generator easily. It has all these integrated forecasting products. And our customer who have it are truly happy with it. So, but how do we get to this point? At this stage as an early startup, it is simply finding customers who have needs that are simply not being met by Sonnen and Brightbox or Tesla, and who are urgently in need of a better solution. A different solution, one that works for them, and they come to us, and then we share our expertise and experience, and that's who our customers are.
You mentioned something earlier, and I want to swing back to it now, because we do have a lot of folks internationally who are listening from India and Africa, as well as Latin America, what we refer to often as emerging markets. Is there a counter thesis as well for emerging markets, or is there a lesson that we might be able to learn or extrapolate on how other markets could deploy the technology that we might learn from here in the US?
Yeah, absolutely. The Power Block was originally never designed for United States or California specifically until the third world came to roost in California with power outages, something that people in emerging markets experience every day. They lose power for 3-4 hours a day, and they work around it with generators and with small, what they call home inverters, lead acid-based battery system. That's what the Power Block was designed for. Also, they deal with power quality issues. People lose computers and TVs to transits in the power lines. And in India, for example, power is delivered at 230 volt. And I have heard anecdotally from my contacts in India, my family is also from India, they run the voltage all the way down to 80 volt until the turn off the power line. And you can, during a brownout that we have experienced in California. So you can imagine that a lot of equipment doesn't like that very much. So the Power Block was designed to put yourself in between the utility and the customer. It completely isolates the customer from utility problems because we don't grid tie. We grid connect through a rectifier, which accepts all kinds of bad voltages and turns it into direct current and puts it onto a system, which in turn then delivers the whole power to the house at essentially hospital-grade power.
I can see having worked throughout Latin America, and I mean, even notably now, anyone who's paying attention, Puerto Rico going through the doldrums they are with PREPA, right? Like, this is a very salient conversation that's easily recognizable and understood by someone in Puerto Rico or Guatemala, or heck, even in Mexico, where I've spent the better part of the last year and a half. So it's really interesting how emerging markets can illustrate for us the need for this technology interface between the utility and the mounting problems that we see with the current, we'll call it existing or legacy utility infrastructure, and the direction that the utility infrastructure of the future will eventually take, which is distributed, which is virtual, et cetera.
Yeah, and I want to make a clear point. Utilities are not going to go away. There are people who cannot install solar panels on their roofs. We have high concentration. We have the urbanization of the world occurring. But the last mile, again, of the famous example of the mobile phone industry, is indeed a last mile because mobile phones are not walkie-talkies. A walkie-talkie would be an off-grid system. A mobile phone is completely dependent on the grid. Your signal goes typically a mile or less to a cell phone tower, gets picked up and goes into fiber optics and goes underneath the ground and connects you to the rest of the world. And then some in India, underneath it comes goes on an undersea cable, comes out in India, goes to a cell phone tower, and goes 1 mile to my family in India. But the game changer was that last mile. And the last mile analogy for the power industry is that high power requirement. So even if people didn't have a solar panel on their roof because they don't have the space, a high power battery in the home could again turn the grid into an energy grid rather than a power grid and help them with all the problems that relate to infrastructure.
Arnold, you have been around inspirational leaders, mentors, entrepreneurs. You mentioned how instrumental your thesis advisor was in a private conversation in helping you sort of make some go-forward decisions. What are some key lessons or takeaways for you from some of these important mentors and leaders in your life?
I think the importance of a mentor and the personal touch, if you will, cannot be underestimated. And something that's unfortunately missing right now for a year or so for our young entrepreneurs or high school students or middle schoolers. And in my case, during my life, it was in middle school and then later in high school and then ultimately at university, where there's always a person that walked in and said something or touched me in a way that made me feel I can do it, right? And that's, I think, incredibly important for everyone. And so from my side, I'm trying to be very generous and deliberate and conscious about it. So when I meet people that have an idea or they want to do something, I will say from the start that this is one opinion, one view. There are many views out there, but here's what I think, and here's what I want you to think about yourself. And the one thing I share with everyone was a piece of wisdom I got from a private equity investor years ago in energy, when I was sitting down negotiating a deal where he was on my side negotiating with me, and the other party left the room briefly and looked at me and said, "Arnold, never negotiate against yourself," because I briefly, kind of taken the other and the other side of, and what I mean by that and the way I interpreted it was never say no to yourself. Right? Never negotiate against yourself. Let the start engine community decide that your investment isn't worth it and let them tell you that. Don't say, "Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to launch. What if I have a bad fundraising campaign?" Let everyone else say no, because chances are you're typically your biggest obstacle. And often mentors are so important to recognize you, hopefully in my case as well, and say, "Look, no, you can do this." And touch you on the shoulder and say, "Go. Go for it." And I think that's very valuable. And I try to do the same thing.
I love that. The idea that a mentor can and does in many ways serve as a catalyst. They serve as a springboard for you. And I wrote down, and I'm thinking about very specific examples in my own life now, don't restrict yourself from the process just based on your fear of the outcomes.
Yeah, very much so. And the fear of failure, the fear of the unreasonable fear of being found out that you're not as good as you think you are, or the fear of you project yourself something that you don't believe you're not. You need to set those all aside and just be yourself and go out there and let the market say no, and don't say no to yourself.
What other advice from 16 plus years of entrepreneurship might you have for someone else who's in the throes of startup life right now?
Oh, well, number one, you will always underestimate how much money you need to get your product into the market or your venture off the ground. And that's perfectly okay. Everyone made the same mistake, and that's natural and good and doesn't make you a poor planner. The second thing is that whatever forecast of your business you will make will inevitably be wrong, because it's difficult to predict the future. And take the two founders of Google. They should be so ashamed of the business plan they put forth, because it was entirely wrong. They were way more successful than anticipated. So, it can go both ways. And so don't just go out with a reasonable expectation, try to size up the market, try to come up whether you're profitable, but don't put too much weight on yourself.
Do you find that entrepreneurs will look at a wrong data set, or they'll consider the wrong TAM? How do you advise folks that are trying to size up the market specifically?
You have to be within the ballpark, right? For example, let's say you want to start a tent company, and there's already about 100 companies out there that make tents, custom tents, and all you need is a sewing machine and a hacksaw to cut the poles. So first of all, you're realizing that the threshold is small to get into the market, right? There's very few barriers to get into this. And the next thing is you look around and say, well, the tent market is a $100 million market a year in the United States. Well, it turns out circus tents, beer tents, and tents for market stands account for $98 million, and in that's a $2 million market, say, for true camping tents, right? In which market you already have 100 people competing. You need to know these numbers and be realistic about them. On the other side, don't let yourself be too constrained by the total accessible market that you refer to as TAM, because sometimes you're creating a market, right? What was the total accessible market for the car phone? Remember the car phone? My father had a car phone. Well, the total accessible market for the car phone was, you know, a couple hundred thousand, maybe a businessman in Germany and the United States. But if you were a visionary back then, you would have said, no, I'm not building a car phone. I'm competing against all of those landlines. And I'm going to give teenagers phones, people that haven't had phones before.
That's right.
And so that, you know, a product can completely create a market as well.
Is there a book or perhaps a set of books that you've gifted or recommended the most that have to do with life or leadership?
Yes. Well, the one book I made everyone read in my first company, SkyFuel, and hopefully a second edition is as good as the first one, was Yvon Chouinard's, the founder of Patagonia, Let My People Go Surfing. I spent $150,000. I love Columbia Business School, and I took so much away from it. I spent $150,000 at Columbia Business School in tuition, and I could have just bought the book for $15 and read it. But the truth is, I would have never understood it in a way I understand it after having gone through business school for 2 years and started SkyFuel at the same time. It is a fantastic book. And it's, you know, if there's a businessman that knows business, it's Yvon Chouinard, paradoxically. The anti-businessman is one of the smartest businessmen out there. And so, yes, if you have time, read that book. It's been a while I've read it, but when I read it, I was transformed. Every page I marked, you know, think, that's it. Every customer is important. Don't lose a single customer. Fight for every customer. Those are the kind of things that I learned from that book. I really like it.
Is there anything on your nightstand now that you're currently indulging in?
Yes, but it's unrelated to business, if you don't mind. But I've been always interested in wilderness travel. I've been up north in Canada. I've taken my kids to the Boundary Waters for canoeing. And I've always been interested in wilderness medicine and emergency medicine and off-grid medicine. Not because I'm waiting for the end of the world and a doomsday, but I always like the idea that in an emergency, at least initially, I can help myself. And that goes back to having power when there's no power. I believe to live in a society, I don't believe that the cabin in the woods is the destination for us or the world, but I like the idea that we can respond intelligently or well to make the best out of a difficult situation. And so I'm reading the new book by Dr. Forgey. It's an extension of wilderness medicine, and it's called, I think, The Prepper's Guide to Medicine. So I love reading that book.
I have really been enjoying the practical insights into how you are going about this, your third foray into the startup world. How can folks who are likewise intrigued learn more about you and your company? Where can they find you?
Yes, so they can find us at usolar.com. And I believe you have a good website, and you can also contact us on that page. And going forward, I think you should keep an eye out for us on StartEngine.
Well, let's end today, as we always do, with what I call a bold prediction. Arnold, I'd like to see what you believe is perhaps the next huge problem to solve in the clean energy industry and what's holding us back. So what one thing do you see happening in the market that maybe nobody else is tracking? What's in your crystal ball?
What's in front of us isn't around the corner. It is plainly visible, and it's to scale the technology up. We have to take it from the success in utility scale solar and residential solar in the United States and move into emerging markets. And we'll be helped by a few things that make our lives so much easier that I want your listeners to understand. Here in California, which is rather south compared to Europe, we struggle with a mismatch of solar with load. In summer, we have plenty of sunshine. In the fall, we have less. In the winter, even less so. And it doesn't match up with load. Even if the load was flat, people would have less solar available in the winter. If you move towards the equator, if you move to emerging markets, that's where all people live. That's where, over the next decades, 90% or more of all electricity demand growth will be coming from. Well, guess what? They have flat consumption and they have flat solar production. We don't have to deal with any of that seasonal mismatch, because the first question you get when you say, I'm going to save the world with solar, is like, well, how's that going to work in Alaska? Right? Well, there's no one living in Alaska compared to the real problem we have and the real opportunity we see in front of us. And it's those emerging markets where the fight over climate change will be won. You know, we are the oldest aristocracy of Europe. we hang on to our jewelry. You know, we don't need more, but it's in emerging markets where people buy, consume, move up the ladder, consume energy. The electricity demand growth from air conditioners alone in emerging markets that's coming our way is equivalent to the total energy consumption of China. Okay. But fortunately, we'll be doing this in a market where that air conditioning is running 24/7 or around the year, and where the solar production is available around the year. So our problem, although big, is a lot easier. And that's what I see right in front of us. And that's what we need to develop products for, that we can forego the buildup of an infrastructure that doesn't allow the easy integration for renewables. And you have talked about this on your show probably more than anyone else. We have a chance to deliver technology that is able to stand on its own for most of the time, use some grid energy when needed, but allows a much more robust, simpler, and scalable, and cheaper energy infrastructure. That's right in front of us, this opportunity.
Arnold Leitner is the CEO of U-Solar Incorporated. U-Solar is a plug-and-play whole house solar and battery energy system. And you can find more about U-Solar and the fantastic things they're doing, not only at usolar.com, but at mysuncast.com, where you can find the show notes for this episode and link to their Start Engine video if you'd like to see how that got them $1 million. Arnold, thank you so much for finally making the time to be here on Suncast. We are all grateful and better for it.
Nico, it's wonderful. It's been long overdue. We have known each other for a long time. So thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, all right. Thank you for listening here. I hope that you made it through that in one sitting. I learned a ton about how the entrepreneur in the ever-evolving solar and clean tech business needs to rethink not only their business strategy, but their funding strategy. I hope that you learned a ton as well. I'd love it if you'd share with Arnold and I on LinkedIn, as some are prone to do, #SolarWarrior. #NicoJohnson as well gets my attention on LinkedIn and Twitter. However you like to engage on the socials, we are there. If you go to mysuncast.com and click on the listen button, that takes you to the blog. You can find this episode and all of the fantastic links, especially the social links. You can get the resources and highlights from this discussion and every other discussion if you just search all the other episodes in the back catalog right there. Book recommendations, so much more. Mysuncast.com is where you'll find all of that. I hope that you're enjoying your Thanksgiving holiday, and I'm so grateful that you have invested the only non-renewable resource you have, and that's your time. Thanks for being here with us on this special holiday version of Suncast, and I look forward to seeing you on next week. Tuesday, of course, we'll have another Tactical Tuesday, and this coming one is a special one. It's Giving Tuesday, so following the tradition from last year, we are going to be profiling a nonprofit that we want to highlight on this Giving Tuesday, where you could potentially consider giving of your time or donation to a nonprofit making a real difference, leveraging solar technology in the developing world on next Tuesday, Giving Tuesday. Of course, next Thursday, we've got our longer form episode. And this is a very savvy young entrepreneur and new friend of mine, Austin Rosenbaum from Demand IQ. Remember, you are what you listen to. You also are what you eat. So happy Thanksgiving. Hope that you're filling your body and brain with nutrition and information that serves you and that helps you grow. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warrior. It's half the battle.